When I was in ninth grade, I wrote the first short story of mine that wasn't set on a faraway planet and didn't feature a motorcycle-riding cat, Casio, named, obviously, after my $8 plastic rubber watch I insisted on wearing everywhere. Why does a ninth grader even need to know what time it is? My watch should have always just read, forward. In my first foray into literary fiction, a boy shockingly resembling myself, probably named, I don't know, Blavid, meets a girl with a jawbreaker patch in her backpack. They, of course, end up making out, making mixtapes, and making decisions completely untethered from the real world. Well, I never did find that girl in real life. I found other girls instead. Girls who had never heard of Jawbreaker, of the early 90s punk scene, of Kerouac, or Burroughs. For a while, that disappointed me, and I kept cruising the shows, record shops, and bookstores, looking for that girl with the Jawbreaker patch on her backpack, her hair both blue and green, someone who would catch the on-the-road references I left on the post-it note affixed to the sandwich I would pack her for work. But then I realized that even this mythic band, a band who I felt was culturally core to my life, whose lyrics are tattooed on my arms, this band didn't always need to be shared. And I finally discovered that having the exact same interests is a poor way to connect to someone. Because most myths just end up on urns anyway, under glass at some museum, languishing under quick glances from the bridge and tunnel crowd on their way to a Van Gogh still life. But Jawbreaker was burned so deep into me so early on that if I had a Tinder profile back then, my bio would have certainly been a Jawbreaker quote. Ugh, probably a deeper cut too. What we learned too late is that things don't matter. People do. Every time. But back in high school and through college, Jawbreaker was, in a word, everything. I'm David Callison, and this, back for another season, is The Sound and the Story. Connect the cable, have sex a lot, a hostile climate, clouds that stick at you, to a condo, treeless cul-de-sac, a non-stop habit, all of no follow through. Well, it's been a while. Welcome back. If this is your first episode, you have 13 previous episodes from season 1 awaiting you. Many fans suggest starting with the Bon Iver episode and the Menzingers episode. This season, we'll see 13 brand new episodes released roughly monthly, deep dives into some of my favorite albums. This episode is special. Jawbreaker is indeed my favorite band of all time. And because of that, I couldn't just pick one album to do. I couldn't leave any of my favorite songs behind. So today, I'll be going through some of my favorite cuts, some of the most intricate and interesting songs from the entire Jawbreaker catalog. But first, I'd like to answer a question a girl posed to me when I told her about my favorite band. Sounds cool, but who the fuck is Jawbreaker? Jawbreaker is technically Blake Schwarzenbach on guitar and vocals, his childhood friend drummer Adam Fahler, and the perpetually goofy Chris Bauermeister on the four string. But Jawbreaker has evolved as the white whale of emo punk music. Its great forefather who, like Joseph Smith, died at the hands of an unruly mob, falling out of a window after being shot multiple times. I'm only half kidding. And its death, Jawbreaker took on a life of its own, a popularity and level of influence unknown when the trio was active. But before all that, they were just three guys who moved from New York to Los Angeles to record as the hardcore foursome Rise with John Liu on vocals. Well, that is until Blake wrote Shield Your Eyes and sang it for the band. Lou knew that the song needed to be the roadmap for the band, but it wasn't a road he wanted to follow. He pushed back against it. Chris told Lou he was out of the band, which proved awkward, considering they were roommates. But out of that turmoil, itself a prescient hint to their eventual demise, Jawbreaker was born. On March 16th, 1989, they played their first show at the legendary punk venue Club 88 in Los Angeles. Soon after, they recorded their debut record Unfun and embarked on the Fuck 90 tour with political hardcore band Conochrist. This tour did not go well. The band stopped talking to each other with weeks left of dates to go. The shows were sparsely populated, as Jawbreaker first ran into the problem of not being hardcore enough for the hardcore kids, and then being too hardcore for the sniffling little indie kids. At the end of the tour, Chris and Blake went back to NYU to finish their degrees. They rarely spoke. Later, Blake would write a song, appropriately called Tour Song. Miles to play to 15 Angry Men. I need some sleep. They hate the songs. We hate them too. This show is free. 20 minutes in, I broke another fucking string. Just call it luck. They start to leave. I start to plead. Someone yells, "You suck." About a year later, at the behest of Adam, the band decide to get back together. Importantly, they all moved to the Mission District in San Francisco. The Mission was a punk haven in the 80s and 90s, featuring a diverse population that included an influx of Central and South American refugees. Venues included The Farm, an actual working urban farm by day, and DIY punk venue by night, hosting punk legends like The Dead Kennedys, The Descendants, 7 Seconds, and Bad Brains, and inspired, the founders said, by the desire to create life in the middle of concrete. The Mission would give Jawbreaker new life and a permanent identity as the Dirty Prophets of the East Bay. After settling into the Mission, they recorded their second album, Bivouac, one that contained both its most commercial and experimental sounds. From the fan favorite punk love song and perennial mixtape favorite Chesterfield King, to the 10-minute sludgy title track. Unfortunately, Blake's gruff, oil-drenched bark became too punk even for his own body to handle. He developed painful polyps on his vocal cords, which caused him to lose his voice on stage. And if the polyp had burst or dislodged, it could have proven fatal. However, the band had already sunk their money and their friends' money into a European tour, so Blake soldiered on. But by the time they reached Ireland, he was coughing up clots of blood the size of his palm. He went in to have the polyp removed. The doctor told him not to sing for at minimum 10 days. The tour resumed a week later. had to relearn how to use his voice again. Quote, it was 2 octaves higher. I just had, like, no grit. It was a pretty unwieldy instrument, and I had to break it back into what I knew is my voice. This experience would inform a couple songs on their next album. As Blake sang on In Saddening Around, quote, I lost my voice. I hope I didn't break it. It was 1993 and the band was broke, having given up everything to tour the record across the pond. When they returned to San Francisco, they were homeless and slept in the band's van until they could find a place to live. Chris and Adam stayed in the Mission, but Blake took off to Oakland, where he lived in a curtained-off section of a dingy warehouse. As for their day jobs, Blake was a librarian, Adam worked at a video store, and Chris, in true Chris fashion, was a toyologist at a place called the Imaginarium. Jawbreaker was now fully immersed in the East Bay scene, sometimes known back then as Mecca. In the rancid song, Journey to the End of the East Bay, short history of lead singer Tim Armstrong's previous band, Operation Ivy, he sings, Matty came from far away, from New Orleans into the East Bay. He said, this is a Mecca. I said, this ain't no Mecca, man. This place is fucked. 924 Gilman Street was the holy temple at the center of Mecca, famously spawning Green Day before banning them for life when they signed to a major label. Gilman was the place to be, and Jawbreaker was definitely there. Blake, in a peak creative flow, wrote nearly all the music and lyrics for their next album. As a band, they perfected the songs in rehearsals, sequenced them, and had a complete album ready for recording. Adam cold called famous wizard slash producer Steve Albini, who had just produced Nirvana's In Utero. Albini said sure and penciled them in for his studio in Chicago. Albini was, at the time, doing around 100 records a year and has little memory of the recording. He also didn't like to take credit, requesting his name be left off the liner notes. Jawbreaker one-upped him, though, and listed the producer as Fluss. Albini's cat. Prior to the release of that record, to be called 24 Hour Revenge Therapy, Francis Cobain's nanny was constantly jamming bivouac in the Cobain household. Kurt and Courtney liked what they heard, and the nanny, Callie DeWitt, pushed them to bring Jawbreaker on their upcoming tour. Somewhat unbelievably, they did. This gave birth to one of my favorite photos in the world. Kurt on the bed sporting a Jawbreaker shirt, kind of pulling on it to show it off, and looking off camera while Francis wanders next to him. Callie would send that very same shirt to Blake after Kurt died. Instead of playing to the 300 kids at Gilman, Jawbreaker, for 1 week, played in front of tens of thousands at giant arenas. It would be a portentous week for their future, mainly because of another record that had just come out, Green Day's Dookie. Dookie, like Nevermind did in Seattle, sent major label reps scurrying Gilman, The Farm, and other clubs to find the next Billy Joel Armstrong. Fans of Jawbreakers were worried about the Nirvana tour. They saw it as the first step to selling out. But they deeply loved 24-Hour Revenge Therapy, and many retained their fanatic infatuation with Blake and crew. Jeff Spiegel, founder of Skeen Records, said, "You'd be hard-pressed to find anybody who was interested in independent music in the early 90s who wouldn't cite Jawbreaker as one of the more significant bands around. If you didn't make out to a Jawbreaker song or wallow in self-pity after breaking up with somebody to a Jawbreaker song, then I don't know what you were doing." The Green Day guys themselves were noted fans. And although still underground, gushing fan letters came from all over the world. Jawbreaker moved people in a way few bands do. Jawbreaker started playing bigger music and bigger venues for bigger fans, all the while denying, on stage and off, that they had any interest in joining a major label. But then, of course, they did. Jawbreaker signed to DGC Records for $1 million. The reaction was swift and harsh, with quote-unquote fans heckling the band at their own shows. The Zine of Record and East Bay Punk, Maximum Rock and Roll, wrote screeds against them. Ben Weasel, the obnoxious but influential frontman of Screeching Weasel, and writer at Maximum Rock and Roll, penned a particularly critical column with a picture of him eating his own hat, fulfilling a promise he made if Jawbreaker ever signed. And I've heard two explanations of why Jawbreaker eventually signed to a major label. One was that they felt they no longer had the money or the potential to make the money they needed to continue the band. Blake especially had a vision for their next album, a cleaner sound where Blake could be really heard in every sense. Also heard that the tensions in the band were tight. They were always tight, but now especially for a variety of reasons. Chris was drinking a lot, Blake was moody as ever, and they all felt that if they didn't sign, they would just break up. So they signed, as Blake later described, on a whim. Right or wrong, it is hard to describe the deep betrayal those Gilman punks felt when Jawbreaker signed to a major label. They had just watched Green Day sign, and all their fears came true. Huge corporate tours, MTV exposure, Rolling Stone, harbingers of vultures swooping in to pick apart the scene. To get a sense of what it was like back then, I want to read a review of their major label debut from 1995. This is out of the Spokesman Review by Nathan Mauger. "It's often a sad day when an underground band releases a new album on a major label. Bay Area band Jawbreaker's new album from DGC is a perfect and not uncommon example. It not only means Jawbreaker will never play around here for less than $10 and without a troupe of quote-unquote moshers, is that they will never be making music like they used to. Gone are the catchy, hard-driving songs that made Jawbreaker one of the best punk bands around. Now, they have been studioized. The new sound is gauzy and soft. It's Jawbreaker, cough syrup style." He ends with, "But Dear You is still a grave marker of sorts for Jawbreaker. It represents the death of a great band. Coming out of the same scene that crossover bands Green Day and Rancid came from, it's understandable, maybe even forgivable, that Jawbreaker let themselves be signed. But what's not understandable is that they let themselves be controlled by a major label, and the product is a creamy, radio-friendly album that could go over big with the kids at the mall. Rest in peace, Jawbreaker."
So I won't miss. I taste our last.
This was when music scenes mattered. This might be the hardest thing out of all of this to understand. The scene was your life. Your friends were in the scene. Your girlfriend was in the scene. Your ex-girlfriend was in the scene. The people you talked to, the parties you went to, the things you talked about, they all revolved around a community of punk rock. This community was sacred. Seen either as a legitimate way to escape an increasingly rapacious capitalist system that cares solely about the acclimation of wealth for giant faceless multinational corporations, or a cool shelter for arrested development, allowing mostly young, disenchanted men to hide from any sense of normal society. Regardless, they deeply hated anyone who would pull the drapes of the real world wide open and let the stinking light of reality pour into their bubble. As Jawbreaker themselves wrote, 1, 2, 3, 4. Who's punk? What's the score? Jawbreaker went into the studio with Rob Cavallo to make their major label debut. Cavallo's most recent credit? Producing Green Day's Dookie, further raising expectations that Jawbreaker would be, as one journalist wrote, the thinking man's Green Day. Recording lasted 2 months, but Chris and Adam were only present for the first week, as Blake toiled and tinkered with Cavallo for the remaining months. Chris was especially miffed at what he saw as Blake's prima donna behavior. Blake, free of those vocal cord polyps, sang in a smoother, oil-free manner, making his sometimes indecipherable vocals of the past now crystal clear. The album, Dear You, was both poppier, leading off with the anthem Save Your Generation, and darker than anything the band had produced before. The record came out in late 1995, and both fans and critics were unified in their verdict. They fucking hated it. At their shows after the album came out, and this is true, fans would turn around, standing with their backs to the band when Dear You songs were played. They continued to tour, but the tensions in the band just increased. Chris and Blake traveled in separate vans. Finally, on tour in Oregon, Chris and Blake got into a fistfight, literally spilling out of the van like an Andy Cab cartoon. Kids, go ask your parents. As always, Adam tried to keep the band together. This time, however, it was all too much. The band broke up in San Francisco. Blake moved to New York to DJ and write video game reviews and eventually start other bands. Chris went back to the toy store, and Adam opened a video store in the Mission. After 10 years, Jawbreaker was finally finished. As I said before, instead of going over one album, I'm going to tackle a collection of songs in almost chronological order. Want is the first song on Jawbreaker's first album, Unfun. It's a simple song, but one that still shows off Blake's lyrical prowess and Chris's twisting bass. The song's main thrust is expressed in the narrator's blunt proclamation, I, I Want You. The verses are about the narrator's secret pining for someone and the fact that, via gossip and rumors, these feelings are revealed. The audience is left in a cliffhanger, with the man or woman's response to the declaration of love unknown. This was one of my go-to songs in high school, as I especially related to the lines, "Used to let the rumors do my work. They got around real well. Now they only hurt. It's a liar's quirk." As high school was a mess of shifting alliances, quiet dalliances, and a page six columns worth of gossip. In college, I still listen to Want, but related more to this more serpentine verse. Dark secrets burn their vessel, tearing out to grab a mouthful. Chunk of heart destroyed by quiet. Yell it out before it kills you now. Let it all out. Only Jawbreaker could turn what could be a pop song into a darkly smart confession of love. Chesterfield King is arguably the most popular Jawbreaker song, the closest they ever got to a hit. It is also, personally, my favorite song of all time. The song was released on Jawbreaker's second LP, Bivouac, which came out on December 1st of 1992. At the time, I was 5 weeks away from my 7th birthday. It tells the story of a boy hanging out with a girl and feeling too scared to confess his feelings for her. "We stood in your room and laughed out loud. Suddenly, the laughter died, and we were caught in an eye-to-eye. We sat on the floor, and did we sit close? I could smell your thoughts and thought. Do you want to touch a lot like me? Too scared to say a thing." I'm smiling just reading those lyrics. I love everything about every word here. It's pure poetry to me. Using the verb caught to describe their eye contact gives it an illicit feeling. "I could smell your thoughts" perfectly describes that feeling when nothing is being said, but it seems like the entire room is yelling at you. "I left your house and kicked myself. I put those feelings on a shelf to die. I guess I'm not a gambling type, but think of what the two of us had lost." We know he's not a gambling type because he had the chance to take a risk here and didn't go for it. Still, he mourns what could have been. It's that feeling when you're being constantly discontent but not taking any steps to do anything about it. "I need some time to think it out. 7-Eleven parking lot, a toothless woman turned and stopped. I gave her a dime and a Chesterfield. She leaned down and kissed my cheek. I was scared, but it felt sweet. It felt so sweet. Disappointed in himself, he walks down to the gas station, where a presumably homeless woman asks for 10 cents and a Chesterfield, a particular brand of cigarette, Chesterfield King, and the namesake of the song. Chesterfields are no longer sold in the United States, but stick around in popular culture. Stephen King's characters often smoke Chesterfields, as did James Bond in Ian Fleming's famous series. Back to the lyrics, the stranger leans down and kisses him, and though he was scared at first, he admits it felt nice. It's here that he starts to change his mind and realize that even though it's scary, telling the girl how he feels could end up sweet. She asked me if I had a name. I told her I was glued up on some chick. We sat and smoked against the wall, drank a beer, felt the chill of fall. She asked me if I had a name, told her I was glued up on some chick is an absolute classic line, a veritable work of art. It captures the all-consuming fixation we have on our crushes that even when someone asks us an innocuous question, we respond with our deepest feelings. So now, he decides to go for it. I took my car and drove it down the hill by your house. I drove so fast. The wind, it couldn't cool me down, so I turned it around and came back up. You were waiting on your step, steam showing off your breath and water in your eyes. We pulled each other into one, parkas clinging on the lawn, and kissed right there. Depending on how you stage this in your head, it's either a cheesy rom-com ending or the greatest kiss of all time. Said my chicks, they smoked these things and handed you a Chesterfield King. Hand your held and watch TV and trace the little lines along your palm. He's being, in my eyes, sarcastic here, winking to the audience's knowledge that by chicks, he means the toothless woman. And this last verse ends with them, I like to imagine, back in her room where they started, as he starts to get to know her in a different way. Chesterfield King is probably the happiest and poppiest song in Jawbreaker's catalog, and it's perhaps this reason that they have not played it at their reunion shows despite its fan favorite status. Blake has said that they tried to play it at rehearsal, but they just couldn't make the song work in their older age. Supposedly, the song was listed as the only encore at the Austin show I attended, but instead, Blake and company ended with Shield Your Eyes and never came back on the stage. Go figure. Say with me now. 1, 2, 3, 4. Who's punk? What's the score? Most of your favorite pop punk bands stole this riff from Boxcar at one point or the other. The 1, 2, 3, 4 is likely a nod to the Ramones, arguably the first punk band. And don't at me about that. It's a beautifully simple song, but like most Jawbreaker tunes, Blake knows how to also make it textured and personal. In this case, it's got a friend, her name is Boxcar. Cigarettes and beer and El Sob. Her hair was blue, now it's green. I like her mind, she hates the scene. It's possible her name and the title comes from Allen Ginsberg's Howl, where he says, who lit cigarettes in boxcars, 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 racketing through snow toward lonesome farms in Grandfather Night. El Sob, short for El Sobrante, is a neighborhood in the East Bay. I think Primus also name checks El Sob at some point, but I'm not sure. You can at me on that one. Blake wrote this song angry on the side of the road in France while the band was on tour. It was directed at the oftentimes gatekeepery and incestuous punk scene at Gilman, but became a preemptive strike when they signed to a major label later on. As Adam said, quote, as spot on as Boxcar was when we wrote it and played it and recorded it, it became more so later when we took such heat for, quote, selling out and going out on tour with Nirvana and then eventually signing to a major label. It was sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way. The next song is, in many ways, the thesis of Jawbreaker as a band. Condition Oakland, also on 24-Hour Revenge Therapy, swirls in an aching turmoil that itself probably created the emo genre wholesale. Blake described it as having a lot of immediate truth and a thematic summation of the record, the loneliness and desire to be an artist in a rough environment. Each line is a clever quip that somehow in context doesn't come off as cheesy. Climbed out onto my roof, so I'd be a poet in the night. Beat the walls off my roof. I saw the big room that is this life. He gets onto his roof, but he feels constricted by the walls below him. He gets rid of those walls, only to find that he's completely overwhelmed by all the space his life takes up. One of my favorite Jawbreaker lyrics comes at the end of the second verse. People kill me these days. There's keys in their eyes, but they're locked from the inside. It always gave me a thought of both Latchkey Kids and the fact that people carry around the keys to their own prisons. The end of the song is a long, noisy fade-out, on top of a live reading of Jack Kerouac's October in the Railroad Earth, read by Kerouac himself, with Steve Allen on piano behind him. It's a prose poem about San Francisco, and Blake found its melancholy a good fit for the song. Here's a little of just Jack and Steve.
And everything is pouring in. The switching moves of boxcars in that little alley, which is so much like the alleys of Lowell, and I hear far off in the sense of coming night that engine calling our mountains.
Jinx Removing is the Michael Jordan of breakup songs. In it, our narrator watches his relationship fall apart and then does everything he can think of, including superstitious rituals he might not believe in, to get her back. Talked out, and now I'm feeling crowded. So the well of the relationship is dry, and he feels claustrophobic even with just one other person. All the errands in the world won't save us now. The banalities in life can sometimes cover up that we don't have feelings for someone anymore. Rained in, and I won't come unclouded. There's a stillness in the air. I pray for sound. Weather puns abound, and he just wants them to be able to talk and get along like they used to. We're too smart to watch TV. We're too dumb to make believe. This is all we want from life. And I'm too dumb to talk to you. You're so quick to listen to me. I'm saying nothing you don't know. Nothing you don't know. The chorus reiterates how stuck they are. They look down on television, but don't consider themselves smart enough to make up stories of their own. They're caught in a very common post-college fear. They feel educated about the world, but too dumb to really make any sense of it. Walked out, and I won't be rerouted. He left the relationship, or it left him. If I don't go outside today, I never will. Depression's a bitch, and it often feels like if you don't get out of bed, you might never get out of bed again. Too old not to get excited about rain and roads, Egyptian ruins, our first kiss. A genius line. You would expect it to say too old to get excited, but it goes the other way, reminding us of the insatiable pull of nostalgia when we get older. And in remembering their first kiss, he already feels the regret of splitting up. I love you more than I ever loved anyone before or anyone to come. Immediately gone are any reservations he has about the relationship. Now he's throwing out anything he can think of to win her back. This feels like an almost manic plea in how soaring it is. Someone just said your name. I thought of you alone. I was just the same, 20 blocks away. This is a gorgeous sentiment. Makes my heart hurt every time I hear it. Blue 12, a kiss the 13th finger. Rabbit, rabbit on the first. I held my breath. Did tricks. I hope you wouldn't notice. A superstitious hyper-realist. I'll make you mind. This is where the title comes from. He's trying with superstitious rituals to remove the jinx he feels he's under. The jinx of not being happy with her. There's also a funny contradiction of being a superstitious hyper-realist. One who believes both in the mystical and the concrete. Every month since I was 14, I've tried to remember to make rabbit, rabbit the first thing I say on the first of the month. I've never succeeded. Every song on 24 Hours is a masterpiece. West Bay Invitational, about inviting the quote good bands and labels to a party. There's a strange haunting emotion when Blake screams, I hurt my arm. And Saddening Around is also filled with some particularly emo gems, from In a Cell We Kiss and Tell All Our Keepsakes, or When I Throw Myself at Your Feet, You Know It's to Be Walked On. We're breaking up every single night. I have to mention, I saw Jawbreaker in Austin on Friday the 13th, and they played this song. And the moment when Blake belted, who would have thunk, the 13th fell on Friday, I say hello, and it's goodbye again, was absolutely transcendent against the backdrop of the Austin skyline, cloaked in twilight splendor. As I mentioned, I have a Jawbreaker lyric tattooed on my bicep, and it comes from this song from Dear You, Accident Prone. It's one of the most bluntly sad or depressing songs in Jawbreaker's catalog, and in over 6 minutes, harkens back to the messy jams of Bivouac, as opposed to the compact punk tunes of 24 Hour. It's always cited in the pantheon of top 5 Jawbreaker songs. Blake said he wrote this song around a period of time where he felt like he was constantly injured or in the hospital. What's the furthest place from here? It hasn't been my day for a couple years. What's a couple more? Jawbreaker constantly peddled in a working class down on your luck hopelessness that was as universal as it was specifically personal to Blake. And if I go, don't forget the one good thing I almost did. I learned your name. Without words, I used my eyes, not my hands. He almost didn't get too involved, didn't complicate things with the physical aspect of a relationship. He almost used his words and not his hands. But he didn't. What's the closest you can come to an almost total wreck and still walk away, all limbs intact? That's both literally and figuratively. And when I go, you'll be there, crying out, begging me. I won't hear, I'll just go fast into this night on broken legs. He's running away from the situation, but he's hobbled. He can't fully run, and he certainly won't be going quickly. This is all wishful thinking. I'm not even convinced that she'll be there for him if he does make it to her. Walk away, all limbs intact.
What's the meanest you can be? To the one you claim to love, and still smile to your newfound friends. In the same confusing breath, pulled away, draw me in. I wanted you.
Near miss or a close call, I keep a room at the hospital. Scratch my accidents into the wall. Couldn't wait to breathe your breath. I cut in line. I bled to death. I got to you. There's nothing left. The chorus here, with its thick wall of guitar, speaks to this idea of merging ourselves into someone. A codependency that brings immediate satisfaction. Couldn't wait to breathe your breath, but long-term catastrophe. I got to you. There was nothing left of her, of him, of the relationship. And when he says he cut in line, I think he means he didn't want to take the time to heal, to get better. Instead, he skipped straight to the exit. He didn't make it. You hear this narrative a lot when folks try to shortcut sobriety by leaving a program early because they got this. What's the meanest you can be to the one you claim to love and still smile to your newfound friends? For years and years, I thought this line was from the narrator's perspective. He's asking his partner how she can be so mean to him and so nice to them. But I think it might be from the partner's perspective, asking him how he can be so cruel and still get along with either the people who made him sick or the people in the hospital. In the same confusing breath, you pull away and draw me in. I wanted you. You wanted more. I built this life, and now it's mine. She wanted a real life, a stable life, not just him as a touring musician or junkie or whatever other ways we indulge ego over partner. And then he admits, and this is my tattoo, that he built this life, and now it's his. It's a more poetic way of saying you made your bed, and now you have to lie in it. We go epically into a chorus, long instrumental, and another chorus. The song is both about acknowledging that pain is everywhere, tragedy is everywhere. We're all going to get hurt. But even then, we should count ourselves lucky. A near miss, a close call. It could have been worse. And in the end, the last line of the verse is, we must take responsibility. Even if it's unfair, not our fault, just really shitty. We have to continue to stand and say, I built this life, and now it's mine. It's a lesson in holding yourself accountable. There are worse lessons to learn.
I got to you, there was nothing left. I got to you, there was nothing left.
I was going to talk about Million right here with Blake's quip about selling out. They offered me $1 million. All I want's a steady fuck. But I'm already way over time. So go listen to that song. But our final song in this collection, which cannot be skipped, was recorded right before Blake had his vocal surgery. So his voice is shredded, which adds to the sound of deep regret on this drinking song in reverse. Fan favorite, and probably the most covered Jawbreaker song, Kiss the Bottle tells the story of living in the mission and realizing that alcohol has taken the place of your partner. So I lean on you sometime just to see you're still there. Your feet can't take the weight of one, much less two. We hit concrete. This relationship is just broken. It's busted, shattered, split all over the floor. These two people, unable to take care of themselves, are trying to merge into one another, a classic codependency move common in partners of alcoholics. How were we born into this mess? I know I painted you a prettier picture, baby. We were run out on a rail, fell from the wagon to the night train. Play on words here, falling off the wagon means relapsing from sobriety, and the night train is both an overnight train car and, more importantly, a high-potency wine with a fruit flavor often sold for under $3 for a fifth. I kiss the bottle. I should have been kissing you. You wake up to an empty night. with Tears for Two. Again, the imagery of Tears for Two, just like we had the Weight of Two. One partner was drinking when they should have been with the other. The partner wakes up to a, quote, empty night, meaning that he or she is alone, and the other is still out drinking. You've been shaking on the job, just one drink ahead of your past. There's a white light coming up. You draw the blinds, hoping it'll pass. That white light signifies death, and then a creative image of just trying to block out that white light at the end of the tunnel, hoping it will just pass. But it won't pass, boy. Just the two opening chords of the song send me into a deeply regretful mood, thinking of the people I've hurt, especially my girlfriend, my family. I'm 40 days sober today, and more invested in my sobriety than I have been in anything in my entire life. I'm not going back to that life, because it wasn't even a life. It was just something to fill the gaps in my empty days, in my broken teeth. But no longer. M, I kissed the bottle. But I should have been kissing you.
Cigarettes, they fill the gaps. In our empty days. In our broken teeth. We chose that. Say, mister, can you spare a dime? Some change could make a change. Could buy some time.
Shit, we made it. Jawbreaker did too. In the fall of 2017, they played their first shows in 21 long years and continue to sporadically tour. There have been vague hints of new music, but I won't be convinced until I'm holding the vinyl in my hands and Pitchfork has given them a 2.2 in a proto-ironic review. This was my podcast, and in fact it still is. It will be back next month. I'll announce the date that it lands on Twitter. I'm setting deadlines. I'm keeping them. I'm also not going to say which bands I'm doing this season for a variety of reasons, but rest assured there will be newer bands, older bands, more popular bands, lesser known bands, something for everyone. I have taken your requests from the past. I'll continue to take requests if you have anything. Here is one tiny clue for next month's episode. I can't stand my own mind. Ooh. Ooh. Follow me, Twitter, Instagram, whatever, at David Callison. That's David, and then a K, and then an A, and then two L's, and then one I, and then one S, and then one O, and then one N. Oh, God, I should take that out. Follow me on Twitter, Instagram, at David Callison, K-A-L-L-I-S-O-N. You can always email me at dcallison@mac.com. And you should check out my buddy Blake's podcast, Good Grief. He works through his mother dying through the power of science and music. It's funny. It's poignant. It's beautiful. It's a lot of the same music that I like and that's been featured on this podcast. I highly recommend it. It's called Good Grief. Go put that in your ears. I am part of the Podcast Advocate Network, and a huge thanks to Brendan for helping me out with all the behind-the-scenes stuff, promotion, marketing, that sort of thing. I will see you next month, As always, stay free and stay alive.